And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Nearly 40 years have passed since the end of the Vietnam War, but we're still haunted by it. Tim O'Brien has spent most of his life trying to understand that long, bloody conflict, which bitterly divided Americans and caused us to reevaluate our role in the world. O'Brien's novels, The Things They Carried and The Lake of the Woods, have won honors galore for their stark simplicity and unflinching devotion to the truth. His latest work, July, July, imagines a 30th high school reunion where the former classmates are still coping with the legacy of the war. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with O'Brien. He began by asking him why a true war story can never be uplifting.
It's beautiful in the same way that cancer is probably beautiful under a microscope, watching the cells divide and that multiplication thing happening. Or maybe the way hell might be beautiful with fire and brimstone and all that imagery.
Or shock and awe.
From a distance. And yet when you're in it, you're not aware of those beauties, the beauties of, you know, harmony of color and so on. You're aware instead of what's happening in your heart, a kind of dear Jesus feeling, let me live, let me live. The way a pig or a chipmunk might be feeling at the moment a throat is slit or on that order. So from a distance, I think war probably is majestic in some ways, and watching the tracer rounds unwinding in the dark. But when you're inside it, of a war, it's whatever the opposite of beautiful is, which is, I guess, ugly.
Well, in your book, The Things They Carried, you have a chapter, How to Tell a True War Story. And there you say, you write, a true war story can never make you feel uplifted.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that even the most uplifting war story is happening in a context of utter sin and evil. I think, for example, of the great story about Hugh Thompson, a helicopter pilot who landed during the My Lai massacre and rescued a bunch of people. An act of incredible courage on his part. He had his door gunners training their machine guns on American soldiers, saying, if you keep killing these people, we're going to open fire on you. An act of great morality and courage combined. And yet it was happening in the midst of a massacre of 500 innocent people, babies and teenagers and old men and old women. Not a single shot fired against these people. So I doubt very much that the people at My Lai are thinking about this uplifting act on the part of Hugh Thompson. They're thinking about mass murder of their own children and grandparents and so on. So I mean that we shouldn't be misled into concentrating solely on the Achilles or the Hector or the heroic Audie Murphy, John Wayne kinds of things, because although they're true, some of them, they're happening in a context of utter crankcase oil evil. And that evil overwhelms these, in my opinion anyway, these acts of individual courage. It's not a popular thing to say, but I believe it.
We're speaking with novelist and short story writer Tim O'Brien. In The Things They Carried, it is a work of fiction.
It is.
And yet the narrator, his name is Tim O'Brien. But this Tim O'Brien is not you. You never had a 9-year-old daughter named Kathleen,
right,
which this character does. You didn't kill a man the way that this character does. In mm-hmm. one chapter, he imagines the life of a Vietnamese that he killed.
Mm-hmm.
There is one story, though, I was curious about, on the Rainy River,
mm-hmm.
which imagines Tim O'Brien just before he goes into the military. He's been drafted, and he has to make that decision whether he's going to go to Canada, he's going to evade the draft, or he's going to go into the army and mm-hmm. fight in Vietnam. Does that have any basis in truth at all?
Well, all my stories do, that one included, have a basis in truth. They spring out of real events. I was really drafted. I really served in Vietnam. And I really, really didn't want to go to the war. I was opposed to it. So, like the character in the Rainy River chapter of The Things They Carried, I wrestled with issues of rectitude. What's the right thing to do when you're opposed to something, but your country's telling you to do it anyway? When you grew up a Methodist and you're told, thou shalt not kill, and then you're told, you better kill, or we'll court-martial you, or, you know, put you in jail. Those, when you're embroiled in things like that, you don't forget them, and they're going to find their way into your fiction. It's going to happen. In this case, I had to stray from the realities of what had occurred to me. I didn't make a journey up to the Canadian border and contemplate crossing it, but I made the journey in my head, and I made it nightly for, I don't know, 2.5 months after receiving the draft notice. Yeah, in fiction, you have to somehow make your readers feel that which you felt, even if it means making things up, characters and plot. That I think is probably why fiction exists in the first place. I mean, it has to be there for a reason. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any fiction. There wouldn't be any movies, or TV shows would, you know, dry up. Broadway would go dark. And I think it has to do with, there are times when, through the invention of scenes and of imagery and of moral struggle through drama, that fiction is necessary to convey emotional and spiritual truths, the kind of things that I went through during the summer I was drafted.
Well, one of my favorite chapters or stories in The Things They Carried is Sweetheart of the Song Tra Bong. I hope I'm pronouncing that
you
right.
You did.
Just to give some background, this is an unusual story. It's told, well, there's a soldier who's telling a story to other soldiers mm-hmm. about this event that took place when someone was able to get their girlfriend into Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But something dark happens with the girl. She doesn't die, quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. She becomes a killer. Mm-hmm. She becomes the worst of the worst.
Right.
There were clear, from my perspective, associations with Heart of Darkness, the great story by Joseph Conrad. And this girl seemed to be a Kurtz-like figure. Again, mm-hmm. a figure of civilization who goes mm-hmm. into the darkness and then is consumed by it. Was that in your mind at all?
It was sort of flipping hard. I mean, the Heart of Darkness was clearly on my mind. That's why I wrote the story. But I tried to flip it kind of on its head, that although she's, in one sense, a symbol of civilization, she's a tawdry. I mean, she's a cheerleader. She comes from Cleveland Heights. She's 18 years old. She's wearing culottes. She's not your sort of standard colonial savior kind of figure that we think of Kurtz himself. I might say, secondly, though the story reads like a kind of parable, I guess, or a fairy tale, it is one of the few stories in the book. There are two that are one of the few that are grounded in fact, and that is there.
Really?
There were women all over Vietnam, of course, because there was a statue to them in Washington, and journalists and nurses and donut dollies and secretaries for contractors, refugee workers, things like that. But when I arrived in Vietnam, I was told that a guy brought his girlfriend over, just point blank, and like everybody else, and like the characters in my story who are listening to this soldier tell the story, I didn't believe it. And then I heard it again, heard it again, heard it again, heard it again. All throughout my tour, I heard it, to the point where I thought there has to be something to it. Then I came home, and after my first book came out, I remember being in a book signing at a book signing event in Seattle, and this ex-Green Beret guy came up to me and said, "Have you heard the story about this girl who was out at the Song Tra Bong Special Forces camp?" And I said, "I heard it. I mean, I lived with it for a year." So I heard it from enough disparate sources to at least give it a kind of credibility. On top of that, there were so many peculiar is not the word, but really weird things happening all around me in Vietnam, a lot stranger than that story. On top of that, logistically and logically, the story could easily happen. All you have to do is, if you're a girl and you're living in Cleveland Heights, you buy a plane ticket, you fly to LA, buy another plane ticket, fly to Bangkok. Nobody will stop you. Get to Bangkok. Back then, you could just fly into Saigon. Nobody to stop you. You could, there were hippies hitchhiking up and down Highway 1 in Vietnam. They got into that country. So in terms of just the only thing that makes people stop and think, ah, this couldn't happen, is gender. That's it. If that had been a 18-year-old boy, there were 500,000 of us in Vietnam. We were all over the place. It was gender. And the odd thing is that people think, well, somehow women don't have a dark side, and what happened to this girl is somehow improbable. When, of course, we know just through living, there are plenty of women who, Lizzie Borden, and have done bad stuff.
Or more recently, don't forget, there were women who tortured Abu Ghraib.
Absolutely.
They, you know, who was holding the leash?
Absolutely.
It was a woman.
It was a woman. And it seems to me kind of sexist. I mean, I think the readers look at my story as sexist, but it's the opposite. It's saying we're all human beings. We all have dark sides and light sides. But in a situation such as a war or a concentration camp or any trauma, the dark side was going to be exposed by the trauma, whether it's a man or a woman.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Tim O'Brien. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Tim O'Brien, whose Vietnam War novels have been universally acclaimed. He has written Going After Cachado, for which he won the National Book Award, as well as The Things They Carried and In the Lake of the Woods. In the Lake of the Woods, Tim, let's look at that novel for a moment. It's the story of a man named John Wade, who is Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota. In 1986, he runs for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate. During the campaign, it's learned that he was present during the My Lai massacre of 1968. This destroys his political career. He loses in a landslide. He and his wife, Kathy, go to this area, which borders, I think, Minnesota and Canada, the Lake of the Woods. And in that, during that time, his wife disappears. What gave you the idea for that novel?
Well, my own life gave me the idea that I wasn't a participant in a massacre. I was a participant in a war that was on a daily basis filled with atrocity. That's what the war was in Vietnam, kicking around children and burning houses and shooting their water buffalo and their dogs and their chickens and beating up on people. It was a war of racism of the most, you know, acute sort. So although I came home from the war a bit like John Wade, full of knowledge about myself and the world I lived in and my participation in evil. Not on the scale of John Wade, but in some ways a broader and deeper and denser scale. It wasn't one event in my case, it was just a year of atrocity. And by atrocity, I mean war crimes. I don't mean little bitty things. They just weren't 500 people dying at one time. So, like John Wade, I fell silent, didn't talk about it, guarded secrets from the people around me about what I'd gone through. Like most veterans of that war, and most veterans, I think, now coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a inward pressure, keep it inside. So the idea for the book was born wholly in my own heart and my own memory.
Well, in the book, you have these chapters where you provide evidence, mm-hmm. these testimonies. You also insert these quotes from various books that have mm-hmm. nothing really to do with mm-hmm. Vietnam or My Lai. And mm-hmm. I noticed that some of them were about Custer's Last Stand or the fight with the Indians. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that because I'd recently been reading a book by Richard Slotkin. And he came up with an idea called Regeneration Through Violence, where he looks at the myth of the frontier, mm-hmm. and he says that, or he, you know, he theorizes that in American history, there has been this prevalent attitude where people from the East or from civilized areas go out into the West or into some sort of uncivilized area, and there, by encountering the savage and then exterminating them or killing them, they mm-hmm. restore themselves mm-hmm. because the East unmans them. It takes away, saps their energy, their vitality. In my melee, unfortunately, and other circumstances of Vietnam, there was a kind of cowboy versus Indian mentality, wasn't there?
Oh, certainly. Those words weren't used, but that was the mentality. There was a phrase called Indian country in Vietnam. That meant going out into the bush where the Viet Cong were, and we called it going into Indian country. The impulse toward brutality was, as I said earlier, it was a very racist war. I can't repeat on the radio the words we used for the enemy, but they weren't nice. And that was the general attitude toward these people. They were less than people, actually. They were subhuman, a kind of subspecies of our species. The mythology that surrounded the enemy. They feel no pain. They can melt through barbed wire. You know, there was a whole narrative about the enemy that essentially reduced the enemy to somewhat less than people or less than human beings. Well, that too I brought home with me, the memories of my own witness of that kind of behavior, but also my own subtle corrosion that happened inside me as a result of going along with it all. You're immersed in evil for 365 days, you're going to come home corroded. You're going to have rusty parts, and the rusty parts are going to be in your heart and in your stomach and in your head. They're going to find the rust and the corrosion is going to worm its way into relationships, not just with, you know, the opposite sex, but with your kids and your mom and your dad. And what else can you expect when you send people off to do these sorts of things? You don't expect them to come back, you know, fresh and naive and full of romantic ideas. You're expecting the wrong thing. No matter how righteous the war, no war is righteous when you're in it. It's just war. It's just dealing death and trying to stay alive in the midst of it. And this story in the Lake of the Woods is a story about a man who pops. The cork comes out once his secrets are exposed to the world. You're not inside him anymore. His own wife finds out what he'd participated in and what he'd done. The electorate in Minnesota found out. And in a way, he found out that he was finally, like myself, guarding his own past from himself, building a wall around his I'm not going to look at my own history and my own emotions. I'm just going to wall it off. And God knows veterans do that. And I'm not the only one. By and large, if you're in combat, you kind of have to do it in order to keep going through the world. I don't want to be too introspective about myself and what I've done in the world. It's an unpopular thing to talk about because we want to have a mythology of veterans that, oh, they're the good guys, and we celebrate them on Memorial Day and the 4th of July and Veterans Day. And we don't want to look at the nastiness they've been through, which is a little bit like, you know, putting your head in the sand, in my opinion.
Speaking of novelist Tim O'Brien, when writing in the Lake of the Woods, did you speak to anyone who had participated in the My Lai massacre?
I did. One guy. I guess I could say his name. His name's Fred Widmer. He was one of the guys who was one of the shooters there. This wasn't during the writing of it. This was after I'd written the book, not during the writing. But I met him in Pittsburgh, where he was living after the war. And, of course, in doing the book, I read everything I could get my hands on. You know, I've read plenty of testimony from the court-martial of Cali and from the Piers Commission report. And what astonished me about it all was that these, unlike America, which essentially exonerated these men, they just said, that's war for you. They didn't exonerate themselves. They were saying, I committed murder. I don't know what happened to me. They were puzzled by their own behavior, by and large, to the testimony. A few were just bad people. But most came back just full of, like John Wade, full of puzzlement. How could I do such stuff? What happened to that moral core, that little boy full of, you know, the Lone Ranger stories about himself? And what happened to him? And man after man after man after man who participated in that massacre gives essentially the same testimony, which is, I did it, and I'm guilty. And I know I'm guilty, and I got to live with it. Where our country finds, I guess, it convenient to somehow excuse murder, which I find, I can't believe it. I know that if Al-Qaeda came over here and shot, went to some village, you know, outside Miami and killed 500 people, that Miami is not going to forgive these people and so overlook it and poo-poo it and say, that's just war for you. It's not just war for you. That's criminality.
But it wasn't just killing. It was also rape and sodomy and mutilation.
It
was overkill. That's the thing about Millet, it was overkill. And you mentioned Kelly. This is because he was the face of Millet, mm-hmm. Lieutenant William Kelly, the platoon leader. Although there was also Captain Medina, he was the one who was his superior. And oddly enough, William Kelly is a Miami boy. He was born and raised in Miami. Oh. That's an interesting side note.
You're right, though. He was the face of it. But behind that face, there were 40, 50 guys who were participants in the murder itself. The murders over what was really a four-hour period. It wasn't just a quick little, temper tantrum. It was 4 hours of systematic butchery of, little kids, three-year-olds and
babies.
6 years old.
I mean, and real babies.
Real babies. And
in other words, the kids who wore Davy Crockett hats in the 50s ended up in the 60s wearing necklaces of ears and tongues.
And part of my book is, there's no way to justify this. It's just murder. However, part of the book is to explain how it happened. That My Lai was my area of operations in Vietnam. I went through that village a year after the massacre, 30 times, 40 times. That was enemy country. And it was in my AO. And I remember talking to people about how much we hated this place because it was spooky. And it was the hatred you could read in the eyes of the people, the survivors, the kids and the old ladies there, and the terror in their eyeballs, too. And part of the book is to explain a little bit of the psychology of how that kind of mass murder sort of thing can happen in a war. Frustration, and where's the enemy, and landmines blowing you up, and so on.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Tim O'Brien.